Radio Foundation is to study the work of René Girard, because that's the kind of stuff that he had done for a while. And Anne's dad is here. We have two bodyguards, Professor Skirman and John, leaving behind Sophie and Isabel, the charming little ones who were always on campus. I think kids should go to university before they ever go to school. I think it just makes more sense in that order. And so they did that very regularly. But they are unfortunately in Edmonton, or maybe fortunately for you, I guess. So it's with great pleasure Anne will hold forth, introducing us to these complex thoughts, and they, I find them very useful in looking at so much stuff that's going on in society. And then after about 30, 40 minutes, then hopefully you're thinking along and raising a lot of questions that you want to raise about this, and then we can go till 8:15 with questions and answers. So welcome, Anne.
Thank you very much for welcoming me back. Okay, I'll just get started. Any student of history can tell you that save for a few rare bursts of optimism, people in almost every age have believed in some way that they are living in the end times. Things are falling apart. The age of peace and stability is over. Things aren't what they used to be. The historical perspective, perhaps, cautions us against the kind of fear born of thinking that the sky is falling, fear that can prevent us from embracing change or moving forward. And yet, on the other hand, a clear historical perspective will also tell us that there is another kind of naivete that is equally paralyzing, the kind that, perhaps out of a conviction of its own intellectual sophistication, refuses to take real social problems seriously in a way that contends head-on with the pressing and often stark moral choices we all face in real life, or that understands agency and resistance as self-defeating illusions. And perhaps we may be excused for feeling that we, more so than people in other ages, really are facing the prospect of social and cultural calamity, even for the academically inclined who prefer to see things in shades of gray rather than in black and white. It is becoming harder to ignore the range of voices from across the political spectrum who are sounding the death knell of capitalism, of Western civilization, of modernity itself. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with extensive experience working in the Middle East and around the world. He has firsthand and in-depth knowledge of other cultures and of global geopolitical dynamics. Here's an excerpt from an article Hedges wrote last week. At no period in American history has our democracy been in such peril, or has the possibility of totalitarianism been as real. Our way of life is over. Our profligate consumption is finished. Our children will never have the standard of living we had, and poverty and despair will sweep across the nation, or sorry, across the landscape like a plague. This is the bleak future. There is nothing President Obama can do to stop it. It has been decades in the making. It cannot be undone with $1 trillion or $2 trillion in bailout money. Our empire is dying. Our economy has collapsed. This is from an article entitled, "It's Not Going to Be Okay." Whether we believe that we, with the Americans, are hurtling towards the apocalypse, or whether we believe that what we are witnessing is nothing extraordinary in the long history of the rise and fall of empires, whether we believe in the American myth that the indomitable pioneer spirit will ultimately overcome its enemies both within and without, or whether we agree with Hedges that the crisis actually presents us with an opportunity to radically transform our system and an urgent call to a new simplicity and humility. Three points seem indisputable: that we are in a crisis of some kind, that it is not merely economic in nature, and that no one has any idea what will happen next. It is in this context of uncertainty and anxiety that I have recently begun to teach or to try to teach English literature to first-year students, most of whom are non-arts majors. Quite understandably, my students are in survival mode. For a variety of reasons, and to risk sounding very much like that fearful, it's all going to hell in a handbasket kind of person, many of my students don't really care about poetry. They don't understand why, since they are trying to get into med school or business school or want to work with computers, why they are forced to spend a certain amount of their precious time reading novels and plays, and most of all, why they have to write papers about it. This is a familiar complaint. I always heard it from my own professors, but it's also true. That's what I found out. So in response to this brutal pragmatism, I could try to justify myself and what I do by an appeal to the usefulness of English. It is an essential means of communication, after all, in all fields and professions. But I resist the language of means and calculation on principle. And besides, not even I could make a convincing argument for the usefulness of the Canterbury Tales or medieval romance in achieving economic viability in these times. My own status, my own lowly status as a graduate student instructor would give me away from the start, I'm afraid. So I won't argue for literature or for any form of art as useful tools in the daunting project of transforming systems, of restructuring economies, of creating jobs, of the equal redistribution of wealth. But what I do want to argue is that creative literature and the history of literature in particular is not a diversion from these problems. It does not distract our attention away from social structures and cultural forms, but rather reveals these structures and forms in ways that no theory, no systematic or scientific account is capable of doing. Indeed, I want to argue for imaginative literature as theory, and specifically as theory that helps us to understand where we are and that helps us to imagine new ethical possibilities as we face uncertain horizons. In my argument for literature, I have found the ideas of French-American scholar René Girard to be at times fruitful, at others maddening, but always indispensable. Over the past 40 years, Girard has developed a theory of religion and violence, a theory that, in truth, purports to explain nearly every aspect of cultural and individual life. It is a theory that draws on the rich soil of story and myth, and that illuminates the deep connections between literature and religious expression. It is a theory that shows us how imaginative texts, but also the authoritative imaginative text of the Bible, give us not tools, but special insight into a shared human psychology, the motives behind and causes of violence, and the cultural institutions that shape human experience. Girard's theory begins with his study of the modern European novel in authors such as Dostoevsky and Stendhal. On the basis of his reading, Girard formulates the idea of mimetic desire, which is an idea of desire as imitative or copied. In Western thinking generally, prior to Girard, desire is assumed to be a dualistic affair, a straight line between subject and object, the one who desires and the person or thing that is desired. In this schema, desire is imagined as spontaneous, either as a result of the object's inherent desirability, I want it because it is of value, or as emerging from the subject's own unique psychology, I want it because it is the kind of thing that I like. Girard considers this dualism to be a romantic fallacy. Romantic because it suggests that the individual is autonomous, self-determining, unique, fully distinct from others. In contrast, the mimetic theory posits desire as triangular or mediated, involving a subject and object, but also a model whose desire I imitate and who then becomes a rival for me. I want it because he wants it. In Girard's understanding, desire is never spontaneous. It is always borrowed, a highly mobile, mutually reinforcing contagion that emerges between subjects through imitation. As such, mimetic desire naturally gives rise to competition and rivalry. For when we imitate each other's desires, we end up desiring the same things. In this, desire turns us into obstacles for each other. What we desire is forbidden, not by some objective law or divine power, but by the obstacle created by the rival who copies our desires and who we in turn copy. One of the key ideas to emerge from this is that the mimetic nature of desire makes it impossible to fulfill. Human desire is never satisfied. There is much talk in response to the current economic crisis about greed and consumption. Hedges talks about our profligate consumption. Jaws drop over the size of corporate bonuses and payouts. But sociologists and economists have been diagnosing the unsustainability of even the average North American lifestyle for decades. Girard argues that desire is infinite, precisely because what we desire is not a static object that can be possessed once and for all, but centers on the mimetic relation itself, which can never be exhausted. He writes, "Desire seeks only to find a resistance that it is incapable of overcoming." The central tenet of capitalism, I am told, is supply and demand. Girard explains this in terms of the prestige created through mimetic competition, that the value of an object grows in proportion to the resistance met with in acquiring it. And if the subject is actually able to acquire the object he seeks, the very fact of possession will lessen its value in his eyes. He will have to move on to another object, faithful only to the insistent force of desire itself. As Girard contends, when we realize the mimetic nature of desire, we can see the psychological acumen behind the biblical injunction against coveting, which, as he points out, in the Hebrew is better understood simply as desire. The 10th commandment prohibits not an act, but desire itself. Do not desire what belongs to your neighbor. In Girard's view, therefore, do not desire, period. These central features of desire, that it is mimetic, contagious, infinite, and inherently competitive, create violence in human societies. In his 1972 seminal work, Violence and the Sacred, Girard turns from the modern novel to the oldest of human stories, and in his analysis of primitive myth and ritual, challenges many then-held assumptions of anthropological inquiry. Inquiry and comparative religion. Here, Girard puts forward the thesis that, first of all of the prohibitions and taboos that structure traditional societies can be understood as attempts to safeguard the social order from mimetic rivalries. And secondly, that all traditional rituals, reflect or reenact an original sacrificial murder believed to have saved the community from a mimetic crisis. I'll come back to this in a minute. All ritual, in other words, reflects a belief in redemptive violence. Mimetic rivalries, by their very nature, tend to multiply and spread, and eventually they lead to what Girard calls a mimetic crisis. This is a situation in which there is an accumulation of rivalries converging on one model object, characterized by ever-intensifying cycles of reciprocal violence that escalate until they threaten to dissolve the entire social order into chaos. Since a mimetic crisis is one in which everyone is a rival for each other, all people become the same in the reciprocity of conflict. Consequently, what traditional prohibitions have in common is that they all seek to enforce differences. To enforce boundaries and differences is to safeguard against the chaos of mimetic sameness, the war of all against all. Thus, Girard points out that in some societies, whenever twins are born, one or both are killed. Other societies prohibit imitative behavior. One must not copy the gesture of another member of the community or repeat his words. In others, anthropologists have observed an acute fear of mirrors, and so on. Along similar lines, Girard argues that traditional religious rituals are another form of protection against mimetic rivalries. Girard first shows that the apparent differences between rituals in different traditions can be interpreted in terms of a shared basic structure. All rituals, he argues, reenact the immolation of a single victim, and they do so because of the restorative effect that an original founding murder had for the community. In ritually reenacting this original sacrifice, the community is attempting to maintain the positive, peaceful effects of that murder. This is how Girard understands the original murder and its connection to myth. I'll just give you a sort of picture of it. Because of its mimetic nature, the conflict that erupts between rivals is apt to spread contagiously throughout the entire social order until it reaches a crisis point and threatens to destroy the order from within. Mimetic desire creates a war of all against all, with each one believing that the other is out to defeat his or her bid for the mimetically desired object. At this point, what that object is becomes basically irrelevant. The rivals are focused on each other as obstacles to be overcome, and the object itself fades from view. As the rivals in conflict focus on each other, imitating each other in reciprocal violence, the community eventually reaches a moment when it becomes united in its frenzy against a single individual. So the war of all against all turns into a war of all united against one. And in turning their aggression towards a single target, the community is reconciled. This communal reconciliation at the expense of the single victim, Girard calls the scapegoat mechanism. The victim typically bears one or more of the traditional marks of the scapegoat, such as physical disability, ethnic or religious minority, kingship. The scapegoat is typically the outsider or the supreme insider, who is also marginal vis-a-vis the group. These marks allow the community to kill the victim without fear of retribution, but otherwise, the choice of victim is purely arbitrary. That is, the victim is not killed because of these marks. So in reality, the victim has absolutely nothing to do with the chaos for which he is blamed. That's the key point. The victim is charged with one or a variety of the archetypal polluting crimes, such as incest, parricide, or sacrilege, and as punishment is expelled or killed. By destroying the one it believes to be the sole and true perpetrator, the group purges itself of its violent frenzy. The killing draws the group together against a common enemy. And in religions and systems of thought that are rooted anthropologically in this belief in the guilt of the scapegoat, violence is redemptive because it is the means of healing the rifts in familial and social relationships. Violence drives out violence. In the midst of a mimetic crisis, the members of the community are not aware of the true cause of the chaos, that the cause lies in themselves, in their clashing desires. They tend to perceive the problem in externalized forms, such as divine retribution or natural catastrophe. The key principle to remember about the structure of this crisis is the fact that it is characterized by the breakdown of differences between people. We are used to thinking that conflicts arise because of differences, because we are intolerant of other people's difference, or because we have differences of opinion. The key insight here is that conflicts arise because of the mimetic movement towards sameness. We clash not because we are different, but because we are the same, and specifically because we desire the same things. And because of this danger of sameness, mimetic crises are typically experienced as breakdowns in the social and cultural categories that impose distance between things and people. They are experienced as a chaos of sameness. Girard argues that whether or not the victim has actually slept with his mother or killed his father is beside the point. The victim is blamed because what Girard calls false guilt has been attributed to him. And the group sincerely believes that he alone is responsible for the crisis, the divine judgment, the vengeance of the Furies, raining down in the form of plague, failed crops, chaos in the streets, economic and social collapse. These events are attributed specifically to the polluting presence of the scapegoat, and the violent sacrifice that ensues is meant to appease the angry deity and restore social and natural harmony. The collective belief in the guilt of the scapegoat is of paramount importance. The group doesn't know that it is attacking a scapegoat in the way that we use the term today. From the perspective of the Girardian mob, the victim really has committed these crimes, and that is precisely why he must be destroyed. If the group did know, if it was aware that the person they were killing or expelling was in fact innocent, was not the true cause of the disorder, the mechanism by which peace was restored would never work. This principle of delusion or illusion is a central feature of the mythologies that are constructed on the basis of the sacrificial murder. We don't have direct access to this founding killing, this founding sacrificial killing, this archetypal event on which Girard rests his entire theory. There are no clear-eyed historical chronicles that describe the facts of what happened. All we have are traces in the form of stories and myths. And this is getting into the chapters on representation that I believe you read for tonight. So these stories that we do have, naturally, were not written by the victim, but by the group who killed him, who believed that he was guilty, who didn't completely understand why chaos broke out in the first place, but knew only that after the scapegoat was killed, peace and order returned. Girard identifies scores of myths that can be analyzed according to this framework, and on the principle that these myths, above all, do not announce or describe the phenomenon by which the scapegoat is sacrificed by the community, but conceal the fact that the scapegoat was sacrificed by the community. Sometimes the responsibility for the violence is laid on the gods. Sometimes the victim is represented as voluntarily offering himself in sacrifice, but these are features of the representation designed to conceal the guilt of the community. The scapegoat ritual in Leviticus, from which we get the term itself, Girard understands as a kind of vestige in which the sacrifice of a human victim has been replaced by the expulsion of an animal victim, and one in which the mechanism by which the group deceives itself is beginning to falter. But in contrast, in the myth of Oedipus, the plague that descends on Thebes is a direct result of the fact that Oedipus has offended the laws of nature by killing his father and marrying his mother. And he must be punished in order to liberate his people from the burden that afflicts them. In a Girardian reading, the myth on which Sophocles bases his play records an actual historical event, but the figure of Oedipus was in reality blamed falsely for the crisis and was punished, not by his own hand, not by the god Apollo, but by the group in its mimetic frenzy. More recently, the 14th century French poet Machaut tells us that the Jews of Navarre caused the plague by poisoning the rivers. God sent his judgment in the form of a rain of stones in order to reveal his displeasure and expose the perpetrators. The Jews were then killed, and after their deaths, health and order were restored to the region. Of course, we know that in reality, the Jews of Navarre did no such thing. They were falsely accused and barbarically slaughtered by their Christian neighbors. Another term that Girard introduces to describe sacrificial myths of redemptive violence, such as these, is persecution texts. Texts that describe and thus reproduce the persecution of an innocent victim from the perspective of the persecutor. But Girard also introduces the idea of representation by asking us to reconsider the obvious. He points out first that we are, as contemporary people, extremely skilled in decoding representations of victimization in myths and in texts of all kinds. Girard observes that our society is the most preoccupied with victims of any that ever was. Even if it is insincere, a big show, the phenomenon has no precedent, no historical period, no society we know has ever spoken of victims as we do. This remarkable concern for victims provides the impetus, especially among modern scholars, for the perpetual task of uncovering hidden victims in texts and histories of various kinds. How are we able to decode persecution texts in this way? Why is it that as a culture we seem instinctively to sympathize with victims of collective violence, to the extent that linguistically we have at our disposal the term scapegoat to mean someone who is wrongfully blamed for the crimes or failures of others? This is, after all, a term and a meaning, a specific meaning that is not present in all cultures. And it is in response to this question that Girard shifts his footing somewhat, from that of a literary scholar turned cultural theorist or anthropologist to that of a Christian apologist. For Girard argues that it is the Gospels of the New Testament alone that fully expose the truth of the scapegoat, a truth that other myths, in his view, are designed to conceal. Many anthropologists and sociologists have, since those disciplines began, been fond of pointing out that Christianity in general shares many attributes with other religions, and that the story of Jesus in particular can be found in various forms in many pre-Christian and non-Western myths. To the Christian claim of uniqueness and exclusivity, a claim that is central to the integrity of a faith that is not tied to a particular ethnic or tribal identity, these scholars of comparative religion have responded with a satisfyingly scientific refutation. There are many stories of miraculous births, preaching in the desert, misunderstanding and persecution, followed by death and glorious resurrection. There are many myths that tell the story of a community saved by the death of one, even by the death of a god. And if the Gospels are not unique, why believe? The Gospels are unique, Girard responds, not because of their subject matter, not in terms of the basic plot they rehearse, but because of how they tell this familiar story, because of how the story is represented. Girard's response to the comparative religionists is, in some ways, that of a literary scholar to that of a social scientist. We must attend not only to the components that can be isolated and categorized, but to the whole, and specifically to the features of the narrative, such as voice and perspective, that create the meaning of a text. We have to analyze the text not as evidence, but as story. And if we do so, Girard argues, we see that the differences are immense, they are fundamental, and they are earth-shattering. The crucial feature of the Gospel's representation of the scapegoat mechanism is that they tell the story of violent sacrifice from the perspective of the victim. It is this perspective, which is glimpsed in the Old Testament, in the book of Job, for example, the perspective of the innocent victim, that is recognized and enshrined in a new way through the Christian Gospels. In Girard's interpretation of the Gospels, it is not God who demands the propitiating blood of the one who bears responsibility for the breakdown of harmony. It is rather the people themselves and the powers of the world who alone are guilty of killing an innocent victim. On this point, Girard diverges from many Orthodox Christian understandings of the atonement, which, quote, look in the direction of God for the causes of the crucifixion, end quote, in which God's honor, justice, or anger must be satisfied. Girard argues that these theories of redemption offer just another mythological way out of recognizing the true source of guilt, that we, sinful humanity, human relations, mimetic contagion, bear the responsibility for violence. The Gospels do not construct a myth that exonerates the people telling it. Instead, they force all people to recognize their own guilt and responsibility for violence. The Gospels differ from other myths in that they do not present a justification for redemptive violence. In this way, for Girard, the Gospels are not only a subversive representation of the scapegoat, but themselves constitute a kind of hermeneutic. That is, they provide us with a way of reading other texts, other myths, through the lens of what is revealed in the Passion. Once we apprehend the truth of the Gospels, Girard argues, We can no longer read persecution texts in ignorance of the historical reality that the text is trying to conceal. We know almost instinctively, and despite the claims that the text presents us with, that the Jews in 14th century France were the innocent scapegoats of a community seized by irrational violence. The text tells us there was disease and chaos, the Jews were responsible, and so they were punished. By applying the hermeneutics of the Gospels, we are able to understand some of these claims as true, and others as false, as justifications. Yes, there was disease and chaos, but the Jews were not responsible for it, even though they were punished. The Gospels also, in the figure of Jesus, present us with a model for imitation that does not lead to rivalry, a model that ensures nonviolent mimesis instead of the escalating competitive clash of desires that produces the need for scapegoats in the first place. And what we are supposed to imitate in Jesus is not, as Girard argues, his ways of being or his personal habits, but his desire. The mimetic theory, of course, posits that our desires are never original or spontaneous. Any image of autonomy or uniqueness is necessarily illusory. In truth, even as we proclaim our differences, we become more and more alike, or we are all different in the same way. In contrast, Girard writes, from I See Satan Fall Like Lightning, the invitation to imitate the desire of Jesus may seem paradoxical, for Jesus does not claim to possess a desire proper, a desire of his very own. Contrary to what we ourselves claim, he does not claim to be himself. He does not flatter himself that he obeys only his own desire. His goal is to become the perfect image of God. Therefore, he commits all his powers to imitating his Father. In inviting us to imitate him, he invites us to imitate his own imitation. And why does Jesus regard the Father and himself as the best model for all humans? Because neither the Father nor the Son desires greedily, egotistically. God makes his Son rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends his rain on the just and on the unjust. God gives to us without counting, without marking the least difference between us. If we imitate the detached generosity of God, then the trap of mimetic rivalries will never close over us. In other words, we cannot stop desiring mimetically, and we shouldn't aspire to, for mimetic desire is what allows us to transcend mere instinct and material need. But we can choose models for desire that do not lead to rivalry and violence. And once we understand the Gospels in this light, as a means of nonviolent redemption from mimetic rivalry, and as the interpretive key that will unlock the truth about desire and about mythological self-deception, then we can also understand the unprecedented modern concern for victims. Girard does not think that this concern for victims is misplaced, nor does he wish to argue with those who criticize contemporary society for its ethical failures. He does not point out the modern concern for victims in order to complain about political correctness or to suggest that there are no victims, and thus to exonerate the power brokers of our society from all fault. Rather, he does so in order to discover the place and the point of view from which we condemn ourselves or anyone we suspect as guilty of victimizing others. And that point of view, he argues, is the one supplied by the Gospels that sees the community as guilty and the marginalized victim who stands alone as innocent. The disciples of Jesus are shown not as the faithful few who stand up to the evil Romans and Jews, but as complicit, as unable to resist the pull of mimesis. Thus, Girard writes, because of Jewish and Christian influence, scapegoat phenomena no longer occur in our time except in a shameful, furtive, and clandestine manner. We haven't given up our scapegoats, but our belief in them is 90% spoiled. The phenomenon appears so morally based to us, so reprehensible, that when we catch ourselves letting off steam against someone innocent, we are ashamed of ourselves. But the gospel revelation of the single victim mechanism has also brought new dangers into the world, according to Girard, for it has acted historically as a relentless force of deconstruction dismantling and removing all cultural forms that regulate desire, that maintain boundaries and differentiation. Today, we are no less rivalistic, no less prone to the scandal of mimetic competition than human beings in any other social order. But we are no longer bound by the safeguards of prohibition, and we no longer have recourse to rituals that reenact the sacrifice of the scapegoat and allow us to purge our violent frustration when the way of desire is barred to us. In this context, mimetic rivalries have become less physically violent, but they are also closer to home, manifest in the tensions between fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, or in the absurd proliferation of pop culture simulacra, or in the brutal inhumanity of corporate and technological tyranny. Thus, what we find in contemporary society are manifestations of mimetic desire made infinite, or what Girard calls metaphysical, a kind of desire that transforms its object into something that appears superabundantly real, investing it with a kind of metaphysical import and intent on destroying any obstacle in its way. This is how Girard describes that. Modern people still fondly imagine that their discomfort and unease is a product of the straitjacket that religious taboos, cultural prohibitions, and in our day, even the legal forms of protection guaranteed by the judiciary system place upon desire. They think that once this confinement is over, desire will be able to blossom forth. Its wonderful innocence will finally be able to bear fruit. But none of this comes true. To the extent that desire does away with the external obstacles that traditional society ingeniously established to keep it from spreading, men lose the kind of obstacle that is inert and passive, but at the same time beneficent and equal for all, the obstacle that for this reason could never become humiliating or incapacitating. In place of this obstacle established by religious prohibition, they have to reckon increasingly with the kind of obstacle that is active, mobile, and fierce. The model turned into a rival, interested in personally crossing them, and well-equipped to do so. Moreover, Girard believes that historically, Christians themselves have failed spectacularly to grasp the meaning of their own sacred texts and have persisted no less than other cultures in sacrificial readings and sacrificial practices, in persecuting innocent victims in order to avoid the truth about their own guilt and their own frustrated desires. In various ways, then, and because we have, culturally, tended to miss entirely the full truth of what the Gospels reveal, we are radically free from prohibitions, but have substituted for them the much more intractable constraints of competitive desire without end, without limits. It is in this light that Girard interprets many facets of contemporary culture, including the obsession shared by many contemporary scholars with difference, with seeking out and celebrating difference, and with claiming for themselves ever new and original discoveries and forms of expression. This tendency is, on the one hand, reflective of the denial of the mimetic nature of desire, a denial that also allows us to remain blind to our own scapegoats. Every school of thought and intellectual discourse has its own scapegoats. As Girard points out, we all denounce our neighbor's scapegoating with righteous self-satisfaction, but continue to view our own scapegoats as objectively guilty. We practice a hunt for scapegoats to the second degree, a hunt for hunters of scapegoats. Our society's obligatory compassion authorizes new forms of cruelty. But this tendency also represents the triumph of the biblical revelation of the scapegoat in attenuated form. Many contemporary discourses have, by and large, rejected the biblical foundation of their own stance, usually because they see the Bible as guilty of victimizing, but they remain dedicated to the task set out in the Gospels of proclaiming the truth of the victim. Girard thus traces the path by which the opposition between victim and perpetrator has become the foundational binary of contemporary thought. Girard also sees the triumph of the Gospels in the modern concern for human rights. And again, it is a triumph of sorts, in his view, but it is also a perversion or represents a partial understanding only. The universalism of Christianity is reflected in our secular understanding of a universal humanity that transcends familial, tribal, and ethnic lines, and that is entitled to fundamental rights, regardless of race, gender, or creed. As Girard puts it, our world, and by that he means Judeo-Christian culture, did not invent compassion, but it has universalized it. This belief in human rights is an indirect acknowledgement of the fact that every individual or every group of individuals can become the scapegoat of their own community. But this concern, too, if it is divorced from the gospel insight of shared guilt and the truth of mimetic desire, tends to create new means of self-deception and new scapegoats. Indeed, Girard argues that any perspective that does not recognize the truth of mimetic desire, that desire is always borrowed and never spontaneous, and that does not recognize the roots of the modern liberation of desire in the gospel dismantling of sacrificial systems, is doomed to misunderstanding and to the dead end of mimetic desire that can never be fulfilled, creating rivalries and frustrations that in the absence of sacrificial mediation actually destroys individuals and relationships. So, in the face of the crisis proclaimed by Hedges and by others, a crisis manifest in widespread economic instability, but also in the global social instability caused by war, by AIDS, by poverty, a crisis which provokes words and images such as plague, tyranny, and chaos by those who perceive its reality. Or perhaps in the quieter crises of broken families and disappointed expectations. How can we avoid turning our sights to scapegoats with the firm confidence of those who know who is to blame? Does not our sense of justice, of morality itself, demand that we identify the victims and that we work, as we have so often heard of late, for change? That we identify also the culprits of greed and oppression and bring them to justice. But what of our own guilt? How many and how ingeniously subtle and complex are the ways in which I deceive myself, in which I see responsibility and blame everywhere but on my own shoulders? How irresistible the urge for self-justification and self-defense? How hard the challenge of self-sacrifice and self-denial that is required to take the blame I deserve and care for the other I have harmed? And how this self-sacrifice seems to contradict the lessons of common sense and morality and the requirements for a basic psychological and material well-being. In the face of all crises, local and global, real and imagined, Girard's theory offers no stirring call to action, no precise plan or blueprint for how to solve the problems we face. We have only the stories we choose to tell and the models we choose to imitate. And the knowledge the Gospels leave us with is uncomfortable, precisely because it precludes the romantic heroism of the autonomous individual that each of us wants to be. It is a revelation that is stark and unsettling, and for that reason easily ignored. But because of this revelation, Girard wants to tell us, we have no excuse. Of us, Christ will not say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Thank you.
So, very modest romp.
It's Girard. What else can you do?
That was lovely. Beautifully opened up for us. I thought of how in the Eastern Christian tradition in Great Lent, and in Catholicism as well, although in somewhat thinned down form, there is a ritualization over a series of services mm-hmm. of the whole of the Passion. Mm-hmm. And all of the words that are said by the crowd, by the various judges, are said by the people. In the face of the scourging, in the face of the crucifixion. It is always struck me as a very profound kind of taking into oneself the revelation that this is about us.
Yeah.
And it's not about, or we are Jesus' community.
Yeah.
And it's so vividly depicted. I recall that there have been, you know, a number of studies done on this and how some pogroms were also ignited by some of those services.
And
be interesting to hear you reflect on how that mechanism worked. I think of one that I've studied, which is of an Orthodox metropolitan in eastern Russia by the name of Kopovitsky, who had just come from the Great and Holy Friday service, where the ritualization of the crucifixion and of placing Jesus Christ in the sarcophagus has occurred, and people gather around, and the laments begin and what have you.
Yeah.
And he had just arrived home afterwards, and one of his servants comes running to him and says, they're going to the Jewish quarter.
Yeah.
They're going to the Jewish quarter. So he gets on his buddy, I'm sure it was a Democrat, and races to the crossroads between part of the city and the Jewish quarter, just in time as the crowd is coming to brutalize the Jewish community. And he stops and stands up in his buggy. And as is the wont of Orthodox people who wear strange drag, this is an insight in this, he takes off his kamalovka. You always know in the face of clergy, if they take their hat off, you're in trouble. And he halts them and demands of them what they are doing. Why are you going to the brothers and sisters of our Lord? Who the hell do you think you are? You go one step further and I excommunicate you. So, it's curious, isn't it? How
it is curious. And I unfortunately, in what I've read from the church in England, in medieval England, 14th century England, I have not heard stories like that, where the church intervenes in that way, unfortunately. And I think this is an aspect of Girard's understanding of Christianity that does, that would raise questions for, you know, it's ironic because Girard is a Catholic, and yet his approach to the role of ritual in religious life seems quite Protestant in to the extent that he has such a rationalized view of it. And you know, one of the things that I find lacking in Girard is any appreciation for the sort of powerful affective role that ritual and worship plays in religious expression of any kind. And yet there is this danger that if you lose yourself in ritual, in religious expression in this way, there is a danger that you know, that frenzy will take over you, and you have to be very mindful of it as being a kind of your engagement with the story of Christ as being a cognitive engagement of understanding the sort of lesson that this is teaching you. So I think that's one way of sort of understanding Girard's approach to this. But it's true that it's a curious irony in I know also various forms of hagiography and Marian piety in English literature too. There is this pervasive connection between the Mariolatry and you know, revering Mary and prayers to Mary and literature that's associated with that, and deeply anti-Semitic sentiments at the same time. And it's hard to understand. And I can trace it to, if I'm thinking from a Girardian perspective, is that it is that sort of affective, emotional, non-rational capacity that has, there's that danger in a Girardian reading for that to sort of turn.
But it's the case that just because you have another model doesn't mean you escape the problem.
Exactly.
No.
Yeah.
So.
A week ago, I never heard of Rene Girard. And I read Gary Wills' book, Papal Sin.
Okay.
If you're familiar with Gary Wills or not.
Okay. By association. I haven't read it myself, but okay.
And his final chapter, it was, you know, fine. You know, his final chapter is called, I think it's Truth and Faith, where he just, brings in Rene Girard.
Okay.
And the whole, your lecture right there.
So it's a critique of the papacy,
yes.
Is that right? Of sort of papal,
yes,
corruption? Okay.
So he brings it right out. For me, it was very helpful when he said Jesus was not a sacrifice. He brings that whole,
yes,
aspect of the wrath of God. He was not appeasing the wrath of God, right?
Yeah,
which,
yeah, yeah.
You,
yeah,
said, he's, you know, when he's writing a book, it's Protestant and Catholic, right? And at that point, I'm saying, Gary Wills, you know, why are you still a Catholic? So I wrote to him, you know, I found him, and I said, you know, what should I read? You know, I was really impressed by it. He said, well, you know, Why I Am Still a Catholic is this next book, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he's defending, and at the same, there's this, you know, this, whatever you want to call it, tension with man, right?
Yeah.
And maybe,
yeah,
in all of it. Now, I'm also very heavily involved in economic development.
Okay.
And you bring that into your lecture, I think.
A little bit, yeah, well, yeah, in an impressionistic way.
Yeah,
I can't claim,
strong,
yeah, okay,
that we are responsible.
Yes, okay.
And, mm-hmm, and my sense is that as a nation, as a community, as a region here, we want economic development at,
yes,
the expense of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I agree.
I understand that aspect.
Yeah.
And trying to put those two together is my issue. The sense of the, mm-hmm, Christian perspective and the reality that the people want, no, don't want to self-sacrifice.
Don't want to self, yeah, I mean, I think.
So it seems to me that the Christians aren't Christians.
Pardon?
The Christians aren't Christians.
So we, if you were, you know, if I try to define or come with a different word, Christian.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the challenge that is, and it's a challenge precisely because we can't make prescriptions like that for other people, right? It's an individual who has to make that commitment. Absolutely. I think that's a crucial point. So Wills affirms a sort of Girardian critique of the sort of papal the things,
well,
that,
yeah,
he talks about, the papal sin.
Girard, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that, yeah, said, a week ago, I never heard of him, and I've ordered the book. You know.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
coming to your lecture has been really very helpful.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Set us up on a whole new track.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's I've found that, you know, being introduced to Girard and then reading his works, at every step along the way, I have sort of wanted to find the holes in his theory and where it doesn't hang together. And but once you get once you sort of get your Girardian hat on, it becomes very difficult to see things. It is a very totalizing theory, and it's seductive in that way, and it becomes very difficult sometimes to get outside of it. But so it's a strength and a weakness, I think.
Well, part of that is perhaps that most of us have been scapegoats, or we've been in a position,
yeah,
where we help create them.
Absolutely.
And so there is a tremendous internal,
yeah,
knowledge about this, even if it's preconscious.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, one of my other interests, and people are going to start to think I'm really strange, but is shame. And I think that there are a lot of connections with what Girard is talking about in terms of what happens to the victim in terms of shaming and humiliation and contempt, and sort of understanding those as maybe distinct from guilt. And I think that certainly that feeling of being shamed, of being of being really diminished in that way by the group is something that is very powerful, and it's if you have that experience, stays with you and is very formative. So I think that's absolutely true.
Paul.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
You were talking about how Girard's view of the Gospels is quite unique in that it dismantles the sacrifice system.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm wondering is this an insight for only those people who come out of the Christian tradition, or is it or can it be an insight for those beyond the tradition, either those who are secular or those mm-hmm. from other faith traditions? And if so, how?
Well, I think that the way that Girard would answer that, mm-hmm. I think, to speak on his behalf, mm-hmm. he would probably say that, outside of a Christian understanding, that any kind of appreciation for the perspective of the victim will only ever be partial and will only ever be sort of at least in part motivated by some form of, self-deception or self-justification or something like that. That's probably what he would say. But, as far as looking for the possible holes, if we want to do that, recognizing the incredible value of Girard's theory, maybe to tweak the question slightly, is to ask the question and to sort of, to take on the challenge of doing the reading and the research. Is it really true that that we want to understand Judaism, for example, just to take one example, as not having that perspective of the victim? It seems to me that that Judaism in particular in the Old Testament, and I'm just not well versed enough in sort of the religions of the world to say, well, no, in no branch of Hindu spirituality is there no something that we can understand as being providing that same kind of insight into the perspective of the victim. So it seems to me that in response to Girard on this point, we either have to say, yes, you're right. We cannot find anything else, any other story that gives us this perspective as clearly and as fully as the Gospels do. Or we say, no, here are all these other examples. How do you account for this? How do you account for that? And I think that certainly I've read some biblical scholarship, some anthropology that will point out, to say that, for instance, the Greek rite of pharmakos and the scapegoat in Leviticus, that those are structurally the same thing at any level, is totally false. That we have to be more attentive to the subtle differences between these different stories. So that might be one sort of mode of responding to that problem.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't another part possibly be, as you're saying, by now, and that's not a preserver of the Western world or immediately to Christians, is that it has become part of common discourse of mm-hmm. decoding these kind of mechanisms or detecting, sort of stories which have hidden victims in it.
Yeah.
So that's way beyond, it's hard to trace where was that originally from. Mm-hmm. So obviously the one work is, in what older stories, if it takes around the same time period, that literature review can probably be done,
yeah.
and it would take some work. But today, none of our, world religions or secular worldviews have grown up in isolation. There's an amazing mm-hmm. amount of influence and sort of always basically, well, but this, way of decoding and calling victims can only come from here or whatever. That's probably hard to.
Yeah, I think it is hard to say, and I think that at that point, moving away from the historical perspective and more to sort of contemporary discourse, mm-hmm. right? To inviting spokespeople for other faiths to say, well, how is the victim represented in other religions? Would be the way to respond. I think that for Girard, the secular, what he might call the sort of secular watering down of the, the perspective of the victim is in several key ways problematic, right? I think that's probably what he would say. And if there are, you know, secular, non-theistic ways of rooting a kind of view, you know, understanding of the perspective in some kind of foundation, that would be, you know, another argument to make.
But Girard's point, if I have understood it, is not so much. Well, it's that, what does the gospel reveal? In fact, what does the whole biblical revelation reveal? And so this is a journey we see in this body of literature and in these traditions, which work to a kind of full-blown revealing of something. I think of, you know, in Islam, we have the extraordinary story of the mystic Al-Halaj. And Al-Halaj, famous in his own day, was arrested and brought to the Sharia court and tried for blasphemy. Sounds kind of familiar. And, you know, they asked the question, who do you say that I am? Sounds familiar. And Al-Halaj says, there is nothing but Allah in this jubah. Hmm. Nothing but Allah in this jubah. For which they crucified him. So it's not, it seems to me that there certainly are, I mean, I know some Muslims who, I mean, the imam and sheikh with which I read Al-Halaj and those texts, I mean, for him, this was a profound, had lovely resonance with the passion story. Not to collapse them, but to say that there's a revelation here that's going on. And also, I can think of the great, you know, the central archetypal Shia formative story of Hussein and Ali trying to get to the waters of the Euphrates and being killed in that context. Of course, there's some Shias all around the world that have passion hymns to these two men, just as they do to Jesus. So my sense is that the central issue, it seems to me, is this reveals mimetic contagion.
Come.
Well, if you could, I'm getting old, and so if you could just highlight again.
It's getting complex, that's right.
Yeah, maybe. Not going out of complexity. I want a cartoon. That would be easier. You say one of the, or some of the ways that the superficiality in the contemporary context of understanding and not understanding this mechanism is that, for example, in our media, we always talk about the victim and the perpetrator, right? And then we have a superficial version of compassion. Could you say a bit more about those and what they are missing?
Well, I'm not sure that I would be comfortable in making a sort of generalization that in the media in general that there's sort of the rule is sort of superficial compassion. But I think that certainly Girard, talks a little bit about where he's critical is when the sort of discourses around the victim and the rights of the victim become not about this revelation, become not about recognizing the innocence of the victim, but become a way of persecuting other people in a way that is sort of disguised. So I think that's where Girard is critical of misappropriations and misunderstandings of this revelation. Not so much that it's superficial, but that it's misused. If that makes sense.
If I can just give a story we had last time, you know, we had a course. What was it called? Same first heading, but whatever we looked at, the next last night, religion over time, was our subtitle. Both old. Does anybody here who was the last course in
politics? We looked at three themes.
Wealth and poverty, peace and war and end-of-life issues. Wow, thank you. Anyhow, so one of the stories that just broke during the time was of the Burmese monks and the military, you know, whatever horrific abuses and jailings and killings and whatever. But the frame then, so the students were analyzing how does the newspaper story present it, and very often, okay, so here you have innocence, you know, in the version of the Buddhist monks, and you have the brutal military regime. And David and I were trying to push people to say, well, okay, yes, but what lies behind that? Like, what why does the story serve the way it's framed right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
So whose interest does it serve? So we seem to know about victims.
Yeah.
But it could also be masking stuff, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
Try and answer that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always been amazed at how readily people are interested in seeing the Tibetans as victims. But the same people have no critique of modernization.
Yeah, no,
and
certainly.
And this is clearly a story about modernization.
No, I think that there are certain there's a certain sense in which we tend to fall back on these kind of simplistic good guy, bad guy kinds of things. And I think part of that is a function of the way that, that stories are presented in the media. It doesn't always represent, you know, other people's perspectives on things. But I think that that definitely tends to happen. And I think Girard's theory does allow us to deconstruct that instinct, to that sort of automatic move to put people into these two different camps for the sake of making easy judgments. Absolutely.
I was just wondering, at the beginning you were talking about original sacrifice.
Yes.
And I was kind of, it was not that I was confused, but I thought you might have more to say on the original sacrifice, whether it's within communities or each community has their own, or I guess it depends on the size of the community.
What's the actual the actual historical status
it works and that's why they do it again. Is that
Now that they do it again, they might do it again, but that it's reenacted in rituals. So the way that Girard explains it and the sort of immediate context, sort of context that Girard is responding to is this is his response, his refutation of Freud's discussion of the founding murder of the primal father. So Girard's saying, okay, Freud gets that right in a whole bunch of ways, but he also gets it wrong. So it's an archetypal event that does happen in particular communities. But that how we experience. So what the actual empirical status of that event, we don't have direct access to that. We can only reconstruct what happened through myths and rituals that reenact this murder, that tell the story, that justify the people who did it.
So that's where their crucifixion comes in as our reference.
So with the crucifixion of Christ, the way that the story is told becomes reversed, and so it's no longer a story where the killing of this one innocent victim allows the community to reconcile, to draw together. It's no longer a means of unification, because the death is no longer understood as he deserved it. We finally have that problematic aspect of our community, you know, dealt with or whatever. I mean, it's not quite that simple. But so with the crucifixion, then the way of understanding that violence, the way of understanding the way that we use scapegoats for the purposes of constructing harmony is undermined. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah,
that makes sense. Yeah? Sure? Okay.
Christian?
Well, I was just going to say, because I've been reading Girard for a few years, and as a pastor and theologian, this extraordinarily helpful interpretive tool and lens to look at scripture and to interpret it for the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in discussion about the where we find victims and perpetrators in the modern world has been offered the discussion of the figure of Osama bin Laden.
Mm.
Has been kind of a scapegoat to me.
Yeah.
And to me, it says he. It's not that there isn't a person out there who didn't plan and execute terrible things in the world, but it's more the way that person kind of becomes the focus of a whole society.
Exactly.
Anger and vengeance.
And it becomes an emblem almost of.
He's almost a mythological. In exactly Gerard says.
Yeah, no, I think it's a perfect example, and I like that example precisely because we can't be sentimental about it, right? We can't sort of say, it really resists that kind of superficial rejection of victimization, if a rejection of victimization can be superficial. I'm not sure that it can, but anyway, I think that is a good example of precisely that the actual guilt of this figure is totally irrelevant to the mechanism that we are describing. Perhaps he did these things, perhaps he didn't, but it's the use that he is being put to as a figure to sort of galvanize action to call people together in ways that force them almost to suspend critical reflection and that force them or encourage them, allow them to suspend critical self-reflection in particular.
It hides as well. I recall, after 9/11, it must have been the next morning or noon the next day, 9/12. I recall watching an interview with Mario Cuomo, the unbelievably articulate former governor of New York. And Mario Cuomo standing in the street in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, this has come to us. We are involved in this. This is part of the fruit of our life as well.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand that. Bang! Mario Cuomo, who was in the paper or on the radio or on television, at least three times a week, suddenly disappears.
Yeah.
Disappears.
Well,
completely.
And
it wasn't that he was blaming. He was saying, let's look at what's happened here in all of its fullness and where we are in this picture.
Yeah. Yeah, it calls into question that one comment that I read from Gerard that we, our belief in scapegoats is 90% spoiled. I mean, I think that the whole aftermath of 9/11, and it's just now starting to, the fog is starting to clear a little bit. But,
I would like you to, if I can, to, since part of the burden of what we're up to here has to do with human rights, I would like you to just walk back into that and tease that out a little bit more as Gerard understands it. Modern human rights and how is, I mean, you did it nicely, but I'd like to bring us back around to that and for you to emphasize it again, how this works and how this may play into it.
Okay. So in particular, how our contemporary understandings of human rights are rooted in the Western context in the Christian story, in the Gospels, that in particular, that aspect of it?
Well, and what he sees as the way in which we use it to also, in a sort of secularized way, to create a new set of scapegoats.
Okay. I'll do my best. It's not my own particular focus on Gerard, but I'll.
You mean this doesn't play in English literature?
Well, it's not what I sort of hone in on, zero in on.
When you
but
back
to
the wife of Bath,
I guess what you're wanting to get at a little bit is the way in which a kind of secular approach to human rights can be a way of authorizing new forms of cruelty, that in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Yeah, I think this is a kind of tricky place to wade in the sense that, you know, I think we want to avoid, and what Girard can often end up sounding like is you know, a professor who, you know, he was at Stanford, I believe in the 90s, and he was dealing with a lot of really intense departmental politics and sort of the culture wars and all these things, and really, really responding to his own particular context, I think, where some of this stuff is concerned. So responding in that way to what he saw as the kind of viciousness and pettiness that could go in the guise of defending the rights of victims and sort of fetishizing, if I can use that word, sort of fetishizing, you know, the perspective of the victim and the rights of the victims. And so, of victims. So I think where Girard is concerned, I think that's really where he's coming out of. And I think, my own take on that is that we, you know, especially in light of, you know, the aftermath of 9/11 and, you know, so many other different contexts that we can talk about, I think we want to be careful about sort of saying that the opposite sort of knee-jerk reaction of reading things like the Tibet situation as being, well, it's just this kind of sentimentalized, you know, defense of the victim. And sometimes I think Girard can fall into that a little bit. But I do think that what Girard's perspective and what the mimetic theory can do is can put us on guard in our own responses to things, to sort of always be asking that question, you know, am I just trying to construct another way of defending myself, of justifying myself, and sort of rather than being involved in a kind of movement that is looking outward always, you know, this kind of movement and looking, you know, surveying, you know, who can I focus on. It has to be, you know, first and foremost, a turning inward, a means of sort of self-reflection and being critical of oneself and one's own perspective, and that's what I take from Girard. Not so much a way of reading, you know, other conversations that are going on in the media as being, well, they're not really, you know, interested in the victim. They're just trying, you know, not sort of trying to see again other people's scapegoats and how other people are guilty of scapegoating, but what, you know, how am I responding? That sort of thing. Great. I don't know if that answers the question well, but.
Question on, you know, the problem they're going to have now with the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
This is exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of a sudden, how are they going to deal with these people that they've been imprisoned for? But so many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that might be a reflection of what's going on. Is how are we going to deal with these people in the context of what we have done all throughout the rest of the world?
Yeah, I know. I think that's a very good question. And I think it's a very difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since the normal processes of sort of legal, you know, judicial, you know, process here has not been followed, and the information hasn't been made public, so we don't really know who has been kept there and what they've done or what they're alleged to have done. And I know it's a very
all of a sudden somebody says, well, we got to solve this, let them go within a year or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now how are we going to treat these people?
Mm-hmm.
And how are we going to do it fairly with the reflection on how we have a, you know, the human rights of our country?
Yeah.
The human rights of their native land.
Of the native land, where they might be coming from. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I
not a small matter.
That is a dilemma that they're going to have to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suggest a new continent of Crawford.
A new
continent of Crawford.
Oh.
Might work. Just a suggestion.
But I think maybe another thing that comes out of this particular issue is the problem of vengeance too, and
mm-hmm.
how to respond to in some cases, in a lot of cases, outrage that we can understand is justified. How do we defuse internationally these cycles of violence and retribution that seem so intractable? The big one is what's going on in Israel and Palestine right now too. I mean, that's another situation where we have violations of human rights and this sort of cycle of mimetic, I don't want to call it rivalry, but the sort of these violent cycles. And how do you break into that? And how do you diffuse those situations? I have no answers, unfortunately. Yes.
I mean, what strikes me from what you're saying is that our current versions of human rights legislation is actually quite inadequate if, in fact, mimetic desire and sort of unilateral, that seems to be the only way to save ourselves, right? That we have to desire what everybody else has. That's the only way consumer culture can go, even if it's not based in reality, like on the limits of the planet or whatever.
Yeah.
So then our human rights, so that will create rivalry.
Yeah.
And our human rights legislation seems to be very weak.
Yeah.
No,
that's a good point.
To deal with what, in fact, all our commercials, all our actually economic plans, all our political parties are all actually pushing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to actually desire some more. Don't stop desiring now.
No, I think that's a very good point. That was sort of the precisely the thought that I sort of, that inspired me at the beginning. I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think in some ways, for us today, Girard's descriptions of mimetic desire are much more relevant for understanding our own role in consumerism and capitalism than they are for, archaic religious practices, certainly. How can we, is the only way of not even curbing mimetic desire, but people sort of recognizing the dead end of that kind of escalation. Because, in our day-to-day life, typically mimetic rivalries and escalations are not physically violent. They happen more in this sphere. For people to somehow, can you legislate that? Can you legislate human rights in such a way as to limit that? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was wonderful of you to come and
Thank
to
you.
Open this up with such clarity and thoroughness for us. So we thank you very much. And I also want to say we miss you. And also you, John. You've been one of the pleasures of this campus. So, and we wish you really well in your work, and hopefully
hear from
you again when the 8 lectures are ready.
Okay.
Chapters in the book.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk more.